You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere. Here are your hosts, Richard Justice and Allison Footer.
I'm Richard Justice. This is MLB.com Extras. We're talking about the Oakland Athletics. I'm joined by my colleague, Allison Footer. Allison, the A's roll on. I looked up, and they were only a game and a half in front of the Angels, and yet they obviously feel pretty good about where they're at.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that what more can you say? I mean, all the headlines are just about how wonderful and great and how everything's humming along, and it's hard to really argue with that because it seems like whatever they need, they can get, and then whatever they acquire, it ends up being this, like, magical fit that nobody saw coming. So once you get on a roll like that, and then I can't even imagine what happens to a team that's young enough to you know, they have the young legs going and they'll have the energy through August and September. Do you wonder if they've even played their best baseball yet? So September is going to be absolutely fascinating because they have everything lined up now to get to the World Series, and maybe this will be their year. Okay, let's bring in the Oakland Athletics beat reporter for MLB.com, Jane Lee. Jane, thanks for joining us. A recent kind of big transaction going on. I mean, it wasn't, I guess, a total shock that Jim Johnson was released, and he was having a really rough time, almost no success, 6.92 ERA. Opponents were hitting 353 against him. But were you surprised? I mean, given that he was coming off of like 101 saves in the past 2 years, were you surprised that he struggled so much when he came to Oakland?
I did. I mean, I think it was a surprise to everyone just because of his track record. I mean, you look at his numbers over the last 2 years, and then he comes in and struggles from the onset and never really got into a groove at all. And no one really had answers along the way either. Although I did hear this morning for the first time, you know, someone was mentioning that during spring training, you know, in Arizona, it's very different pitching in Arizona than, you know, Florida for these guys. And Johnson, of course, spent the rest of his career with Baltimore. And so this is his first time pitching in Arizona, and he's a sinker ball guy, a big sinker ball guy, and his sinker was not sinking. And he might have, I don't want to say freaked out, but started thinking about it too much and maybe changed his mechanics slightly. And he entered the season, you know, not fully confident in his stuff. And it just snowballed on him. I mean, he allowed 5 runs over his first 2 outings. He was yanked from the closer's role within 2 weeks of the season. And everyone thought, oh, well, we'll be back in it soon enough. And it just never happened. I mean, luckily the A's have such a deep roster, such a deep bullpen that, you know, Sean Doolittle became the closer, became an all-star closer, and has handled it fine. But by the end of his tenure here, I mean, last night he gives up 4 runs. He can't even get an out. And it just it got to the point where he was kind of this dark cloud over this team. You know, they're in first place. Everything's going their way except for this. And, you know, Bob Melvin just, he ran out of ways to use him. I mean, he put him in a game last night with a 9-2 lead. And, I mean, if you can't even use him in situations where you have a 7-run lead, I mean, it becomes a waste of roster space at that point. And they need fresh arms.
That's amazing. I've never heard of the spring training location having anything to do with why a guy can't make adjustments. Have you heard anything about that with anybody else before?
No, that was the first time I had heard of it, and I don't know how valid it is because usually guys are able to make that adjustment, and, you know, usually you get back to the Bay Area where, you know, the air is just fine, and, you know, even if guys were having a little bit of trouble with it in Arizona, they kind of round into form pretty quickly. But, I mean, Johnson did have a very poor spring training, and no one really thought anything of it because a lot of guys have bad spring trainings and come into the season and do just fine. So that was the first I had heard of it. You know, I'm curious to talk to other people around the team about it to see if there is something to it. But if it was a mechanical thing, they would have noticed it, and it would have been something that was talked about more than, you know, it was, because there was nothing mechanical ever brought up with him. I mean, throughout all these struggles, we asked all the time. You know, we asked him, we asked Melvin, we asked the pitching coach, Kurt Young, you know, is there something you can point to that is just different? And I mean, even this morning, Melvin was saying there was nothing different about his stuff or about the way he was pitching, and that's what makes this all really baffling. And I wouldn't be surprised if he gets picked up by another team and is just fine. And, you know, he goes on and has a great rest of the season, and maybe we see him getting named Comeback Player of the Year next year. But I do think a change of scenery at this point can only help him.
Yeah, you would think that those issues that were happening at spring training would have dissipated at some point getting out of there, but I guess it didn't happen. Let's move on to, I mean, we talked about this last time also, but with Tommy Malone, I find it fascinating. He can't seem to find a spot on the major league roster given how great he's been, and I know that he would like to be pitching in the big leagues, but he's not going to be traded because that's like way too much of an insurance policy for the team in case of injuries or inconsistencies down the road with some of the guys we have now. What do you see as his future? You think he's just going to have to bide his time, or you think he's going to be headed somewhere else?
Yeah, I think he's going to have to bide his time. I mean, I don't see him getting traded at all. He's too valuable of a piece to lose and just give away. Of course, you know, if a player does request to be traded, it's not like the team just says, all right, well, you know, we'll see what we can do for you. It doesn't really work that way, especially with a first-place team that can, you know, actually use a guy like that. And this is a team that values depth, you know, above anything else. It's what separates them from other teams. They have guys go down and they don't miss a beat. You know, even going back to the Johnson case, you know, case in point, they had other guys come in and the bullpen really never faltered, even when he was going so bad. And with the rotation, yeah, they have, you know, five guys filling it out right now. But you look at a guy like Jason Hammel, who's starting tomorrow, his first two starts in Oakland have not been very good. And I have to imagine that if he has a third straight poor outing, they might have to tinker the rotation again. They've shown, you know, they're not afraid to make bold decisions. And so I would have to think that we see Malone pretty soon. If not, you know, for Hamilton, you know, something else comes up. But I can't see, you know, them getting into September without Malone on the roster again. And they also have Drew Pomeranz, too, which he could end up being used down the stretch as a long relief option. He's kind of in the same boat. I mean, he was doing so well for them in the rotation. Obviously made a poor choice by breaking his hand by punching a wooden chair. But him and Malone are kind of in the same boat as far as just, you know, staying patient. And obviously Malone deserves to be on the roster right now. His numbers speak to that. But it just kind of goes to show how deep this team is right now.
Yeah, they say that those are the problems every general manager wants to have, but really few actually do have. I don't know if we asked you this last time, but just going back a while back after the trade was made with the Cubs, and Justin Verlander, I believe, what the Tigers said, that they basically, the A's made this trade because of us, insinuating that the A's are going to finally have a pretty good chance to beat the Tigers in the playoffs. Did that surprise you at all, or did it have any kind of, did it resonate in the clubhouse? I mean, it's a very bold statement considering the Tigers, as good as they are flawed, and there's really no guarantees that they're just going to run away with anything. What did you think about that? Did that carry anything somehow?
Yeah, it was, you know, it wasn't surprising coming from Justin Verlander, but it was surprising coming from a struggling Justin Verlander. You know,
right,
not
exactly.
Like he's having a great season himself. And so to be able to say that, you know, during a season like that, it did kind of catch people off guard. The general consensus in the A's clubhouse was a lot of laughing. They didn't really take it too seriously. They just kind of, you know, joked about it, laughed about it, and were done with it. And I know Billy Beane, you know, was asked about it when he made the trade. And, I mean, he scoffed at it because he's like, you know, we have to get there first. And you look at the division standings right now, and he's right. I mean, the Angels are just two games behind the A's. The A's have not gained a full game on the Angels since July 8th, which is pretty remarkable.
Wow.
You know, as good as the A's have been, the Angels have been just as good, and they're just two back. And they still play each other a lot in the second half. And, I, you know, you look at what the A's have done in recent years. I mean, they overcame a 13-game deficit 2 years ago to come back and win the West over the Rangers. And because they've done it, I think they're very well aware that it can also happen to them, especially with an Angels team that's so good as they are. And so this move wasn't made for the postseason. Sure, it does set them up pretty nicely with a fantastic rotation in the postseason, but they do have to get there first. And they don't want to just get there. You know, you want to get there with the best team so that you're playing the wild card. And if that's the case, then they wouldn't even be playing Detroit. So, granted, they could see them in the second round. But, no, I mean, it's just the Verlander thing was silly. The players thought it was silly. And, I mean, you just – yeah, it's a little surprising that someone would even think to say that. Or is even thinking it in the first place. But, I mean, there is, you know, a lot of history between these two teams, and it seems like it's only intensifying, which it's pretty crazy because they only play each other twice during the regular season, and yet it feels just as much of a rivalry as, you know, any other division opponent.
Yeah, it seemed like a comment that a guy that was a little more clueless than a Justin Verlander, who has certainly been there before, has played in plenty of postseasons, and it just sounded like something that, you know, like a second-year guy would say without really realizing how ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, and it, like the type that Verlander would, you know, go up to a guy and say, "Why did you say that?"
Right. So, for people that don't really get to see a lot of games in Oakland or are not familiar with the surroundings, I find it like the atmosphere is just fantastic. I know that they just signed a 10-year lease, and but the A's are hoping to someday get a new ballpark. But there is something to be said about, you know, just the crazy people, the fans that are in the outfield. And can you just, like, give us some insight to that and, like, when you have a really good crowd there, just kind of what it's like and what makes it special there? Because people talk about that a lot.
Yeah, they do, and that's something that Bob Melvin brings up a lot. I mean, he'll say, we almost joke about how much he says it, and, you know, we can predict when he's about to say it, that, you know, he'll always say 20,000 feels like 50,000, and 50,000 feels like 100,000, but it's true. I mean, if you were here last night, it was a decent crowd of about 25,000, but if you were to close your eyes, you would think that you were in the middle of some postseason game. I mean, it was just that loud. They get that into it. They're very passionate fans. Most nights, there's not a whole lot of them, but the ones that are here are just, I mean, they're intense, and they're super passionate, and the players realize that. Melvin realizes it. And so I think that's why when people, you know, when media bring up the stadium and just how old and run down it is to the players are like, we don't really care. I mean, it doesn't affect us. I think once they're here and they realize how much of a good thing they have going here, obviously winning helps, but this type of fan base is pretty special. It's pretty unique. I mean, you don't see it other places, and I think until you experience it, it's hard to understand. But, I mean, even I think I heard the right field bleacher crew, they were featured on some national network the other night. So they're becoming, I mean, you know, a star just themselves. And it's fun to be a part of. And I think maybe, you know, if you're here every day, you might take it for granted. But, like, you know, someone in the press box visiting right last night was saying, like, all of a sudden, like, these fans are so loud. And you don't expect it in the middle of a 162-game season unless it's this huge game. But, I mean, the Astros are in town, and, I mean, it wasn't necessarily a big game by any means, but that's just the type of atmosphere they create. And, you know, a lot of players say, you know, they're almost like the 10th man on the team out there because they have that much of a presence.
And it's kind of cool. Like, I mean, everybody has new ballparks, and of course the A's would love one, but it is kind of cool. Like, if they were to get, you know, deep into October, they're the same place where they had all those great times, you know, decades ago. I've been thinking about that a lot, just with Jose Canseco's odd ramblings on Twitter and his appearance recently at the Oakland Coliseum, but he seems to really want to make up with Mark McGwire. But it is kind of neat just to be able to have the familiarity with the rowdiness now to something that you would have seen in 1988.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the, you know, when the, like, the 1989 team came back for a reunion last week, and some of them, you know, have kind of taken notice of that and just how much this year in particular feels like that year, not just because of the team, but just, you know, they have a good feeling here. They have a good vibe about this team and about what's going on. But it was fun to watch the reunion and just the fans' reaction to all these players. And, you know, here was Canseco, who was legitimately scared of what type of reaction he was going to get. I mean, he's thinking that there's like 50,000 Mark McGwires out there, you know, ready to boo him. And he comes out and he gets the biggest response of all of them. And I think he really needed that. I think it was really cool for him. And then, of course, he came back to scoop root beer floats last night for their annual root beer float day. So I don't think they're going to be able to get rid of him at this point. He's now tweeting that, you know, all he wants is to take batting practice to the Coliseum, which I don't think is going to happen. But I think he's kicking around a little while. but it's fun to watch, you know, generations of fans connect with him and other guys, you know, and kind of connect that team to this team and similarities. I mean, you had, you know, a Hall of Fame closer in Dennis Eckersley. Sean Doolittle posting very similar numbers to him as far as, you know, strikeout-to-walk ratios. And, you know, you don't have the Bash Brothers, but you have a ton of power in the lineup and a very good rotation. So there's a lot of similarities between those clubs, and it is really cool to see the fans, you know, interact with both and kind of weave, you know, both together.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's pretty cool about Canseco. I guess time heals all wounds. I mean, you know, enough time goes by and people just like to see, they just like to see their former stars. And I think the media looks way more into a lot of this stuff than the fans actually do. But anyway, I will let you go. Thank you so much, Jane, for joining us, and we'll be talking to you soon.